This is the Tantalk Radio Network.
It's Patsy with a Z, and I am so happy to welcome you to Joy on Paper, a program for writers and those who dream of writing, and for everyone who wants to know the story behind the book. And boy, oh boy, do we have a story behind the book today. I am so happy to welcome to the program Rachel Renee Russell. Hi, Rachel.
Hi, Patsy. How are you doing?
Oh, it's always so much fun to have you on the program.
Thank you. I always enjoy coming and speaking with you.
Well, you know, I love these books so much. I must say I'm sort of a Max Crumbly. I go crazy for Max, but I love the Dork Diaries.
And thank you. You know, thank you very much. Yeah, I hear that too. I think Max Crumbly is like got a more drama and excitement and, you know, whatever.
So. Yeah, and I bet
I appreciate you.
Nikki must have lots of fun with Max Crumbly because the more dramatic things sometimes to
exactly, yes, exactly. So, yeah, I enjoy writing both of them. But, yeah, Max Crumbly has a lot more going on. I mean, that was inspired by, I can't think of it right now, but... Oh, Home Alone. So that it has the burglars
I mentioned to you that I used to love chemistry. I used to love chemistry class, and I was one of those. In those days, I was one of the few girls in the chemistry class, and I was a real hoot, and I was smart, and the other two smart boys in the thing, the three of us, we were just terrible, and we did all sorts of experiments and blew things up. I did all sorts of
mess. Yes, I think Max Crumbly's blown up a dude. That's not probably why you're relating to him.
I relate to Max.
He's a chemistry buff as well.
I do. But yeah. I love Dork Diaries because, one, I print. It's almost like you stole my printing because that's exactly how I print.
Oh.
I'm so neat. I print so nicely, exactly like in mm-hmm. Dork Diary. And so I'm reading it along. I'm thinking, did I write this thing?
Yeah, it looks like your handwriting. And I think that's why kids really relate to both Max Crumbly and Nikki Maxwell in Dork Diaries is because it's their diary. When you open it up, it's their handwriting and it's their doodles and comic strips
exactly.
And all their personal thoughts.
Well,
exactly.
I have to tell people, this is number 14, and it's Tales from a Not-So-Best Friend Forever. And people out there just start drooling. Oh, Rachel, Renee, Russell, the three R's, triple R's. I mean, you are just so amazing. 45 million copies in print. Can you believe that?
Thank you. Yeah, it's a dream come true for me. I was hoping, it's a series, so I thought, well, maybe 2, 3, 4 books. And here it is. 10 years later, we're going strong, and I just finished book 14, so it's been a dream come true for me. And I never imagined, that the book series.
Yeah,
would,
because you were just a boring attorney. I mean,
exactly.
Depositions and all that boring stuff.
I love writing, and I work in my pajamas, and I work at home, and I set my own hours, and so yeah, I've definitely prefer writing full time than being an attorney.
Especially since you've been on the New York Times bestselling list like for 400 weeks. I mean,
yeah, okay. It's been a while.
I don't think anybody else has done 400 weeks. I really don't. I think you are the tops.
Thank you.
And you deserve to be.
There's like Harry Potter,
oh, yeah.
I think.
Yeah, maybe Harry Potter.
And then, of course, Dabra Wimpy Kid is... Yeah, Dabra Wimpy Kid is super successful. Yeah. I think they both have me beat,
That's a few books. You're heading up. We're going to be reading these for years and years, and that's the exciting thing because the stories are you always manage to bring a freshness to them. And so tell us about the new book and what is it? Well, first of all, I want to ask, I appreciate when authors dedicate a book, and sometimes we sort of overlook it and we don't talk about the person to whom a book has been dedicated. But you did dedicate this one. You know, when you write so many, in the beginning you write, you know, for your family. You run out of family.
Exactly.
You're doing friends. So who is Fariah Marie?
Fariah Marie is a neighbor. I'm originally from Michigan. And
Me too. I'm a Michigander.
So anyway, I was divorced, first of all, and then I just kind of moved to Virginia and started over. And I went from being a full-time attorney to a full-time children's author. But there was a family that lived in my neighborhood in Michigan. And at the time that I moved away, I think she was probably maybe only about 2 or 3 years old. And now she's, 13 or so, and she's a big Dork Diaries fan. And she's going through some of the exact same challenges that Nikki Maxwell went to. And kids are giving her a hard time. I think she's even being homeschooled. Now her mom even pulled her out of school. So she came and visited with her family last Christmas, and in talking to her, I was trying to encourage her, and she was saying how much she loved the books and how she related to Nikki Maxwell, and that a lot of the same things that Nikki Maxwell has gone through, she went through at her school, and that she's, you know, begging her parents to let her be homeschooled and whatever. So she touched my heart, and I thought, well, I'm going to dedicate my next book to her. So that's a little bit about Fariah. And I think at this point, I think she's being homeschooled, and she's happy, and trying to find herself.
Well, and you've done something so wonderful to dedicate a book to her. Somehow, when I saw the name, I said there has to be a story behind this dedication. And I'm glad that I picked up on it, because she needs this kind of encouragement. If she loves your books, I want her to be out there and saying, yeah, I'm a Michigander. Hey, and all of us, we're Michiganders, and we can accomplish a lot, right?
Exactly. So again, her story touched my heart so much. I thought, as a surprise, she didn't know I was going to do this. And then I talked to her mom and got her mom's permission. And then I think her mom kind of, mentioned to her that, would you ever want to have a book dedicated? Because we didn't want to do that. And then she's traumatized. And that's the other thing too, is that you would think you could just dedicate a book to anybody or whatever, but especially when they're kids or teens, you have to be very careful, because they may not want that extra, spotlight on them if they're already struggling in school and people are calling them dork and whatever.
Why do we still have to go through all of this in school?
I don't know. So I have dedicated probably my last 3 or 4 books to kids and to fans and to people I know that usually are going through similar circumstances that the whole theme of the book was set up around. But I do always ask, because, sometimes they don't want that extra. I've never had a person tell me no, but I do ask just to make sure that I'm not aggravating the situation, that they're dealing with.
Well, David Baldacci out there, you can dedicate a book to me anytime. The author who could dedicate a book to me is Nelson DeMille. I love Nelson DeMille.
So. Oh, yes.
His writing is so terrific. So you've done a beautiful thing here in dedicating to somebody who I think really needs it. And tell us about the story, because it's a story that you tell about these problems in a way that I think helps young people understand and hopefully get a better perspective on life.
Yes. So in Dork Diaries Book 3, which would have been about 2012 or so, Nikki and her friends were in a talent show. And the talent show is judged by a famous producer, from their hometown. And he is so impressed with Nikki and her band, after having seen them perform in the talent show, he invites them to be the opening act for one of his world-famous boy bands that he manages. He's kind of a Simon Cowell, American Idol type, guy that's, back home judging a local talent show. So Nikki and her band are invited to go on tour with a famous national group, and they're the opening act also. They're, you know, they do their little thing for 20 minutes, and then the famous people come on. So Nikki's excited, and her band is excited, and they're, you know, looking forward to having the most fabulous time, you know, for a few weeks opening for this famous boy band. However, she finds out that her frenemy and mean girl, which her name's Mackenzie Hollister, has weaseled her way onto the tour as a social media intern, and Nikki finds out that Mackenzie Hollister is her roommate on the tour. So her dreams of having this, you know, the most fabulous few weeks of her life are pretty much ruined because she has to be a roommate with a girl who basically hates her guts. So that's kind of the setup and the plot for book 14.
Well, you know, it's funny. I wish somehow, and I understand that they're picking these your books up for a major motion picture, and I hope that it comes, you know, that people and the kids will read these books and really think about being nice to each other and being helpful to each other and just I don't know, I worry sometimes about the situation in the world between, you know, people still not being kind enough to each other and the race problems. And it's so funny. I had thought at one point, I remember thinking, because I was living overseas, and when I came back to America, I thought, well, there weren't going to be any more race problems, and there weren't going to be any more. And anything that you can do to really show people that we should all just enjoy our lives and enjoy each other. This is the job that you're doing here.
Oh, well, thank you. Well, I do try to include diverse characters. So you're going to see the Dirk Diaries characters are different races and ethnicities, and, you know, coming from different backgrounds. And that's the way the real world is. You know, even, and especially in the United States, we're a melting pot and of diverse groups of people. And as I don't mean to sound cliche, but it's important that we all try to get along and be respectful and enjoy each other and enjoy our differences and embrace them. So that's what I hope to achieve, you know, with the diverse characters in Dirk Diaries as well, is that kids can see this and appreciate it and, you know, learn something.
Well, I think that it comes through, and that's important, that this idea of diversity, that in the end, there is, some people can be mean, some people can be just great, but in the end, we all want to just have fun and have a nice relationship with each other.
Exactly. Yeah, you want to get along and have positive relationships, you know. And then you're not going to always like everybody that you run into, but at least be respectful, you know, and then move on and find someone that you can relate to and whatever. So, you know, so just because you don't like a person, you don't have to, you know, to terrorize them and be horrible. And that gets into kind of the mean girl syndrome and bullying and all of that. So I think actually Dirk Diaries is more relevant probably, you know, the past 5 years than it even was when I started it in 2009. So that's a good thing too, is that, you know, the lessons that it teaches and the principles that it stands for are, you know, even more relevant now than it was in the beginning. So
because
I just, you know, hope
October is
a positive impact on kids that read it.
That's what I hope too, because October is anti-bullying month. And it's
right.
And it's a subject that we want to address, and to I think parents will really appreciate the Dork Diaries and having this, you know, multi-ethnic characters, so that they can see that, you know, we just have to get over it. I just so tired of it. And then for somebody like you, I mean, you are a woman of color, and you have made it beyond what anybody, you know, anybody, any color could dream about, to be 400
weeks. Exactly, because we're 45 million books in print, and we're in 40 languages, and that's amazing. Because, I mean, because of course, Dork Diaries is based on the culture in the United States and pop culture and the TV shows that are popular and, you know, teen and tween culture. But the underlying story, which is just wanting to fit in and wanting to have friends and wanting to figure out who you are, you know, as a 14-year-old, is a story that resonates around the world in 40 different languages. So it's being read in Bangladesh
and in Paris,
and in, you know, all over the world. So, yeah, that's kind of mind-blowing to me.
And you yourself are an inspiration that it can be done, that you just have to follow your dreams. You have to work hard because it wasn't easy in the beginning. You had to really teach yourself how to, you know, become a great writer, and you have. And then, of course, now your daughter Nikki with her wonderful, wonderful drawings. You are both inspiration that we can accomplish our dreams if we just work hard and stick to it.
Well, thank you. I appreciate the compliment, and you are so correct. If I can do this, anyone can do this. Everyone can become a writer. So it's just a matter of sitting down and having the discipline to, you know, try to achieve your dream.
Well, I want to thank you so much. I just love saying your name. I don't know. I get such a kick out of your name, Rachel Renee Russell.
Thank you.
New book is Tales from a Not So Best Friend Forever, and another edition of Dork Diaries. I want to thank you so much for being on Joy on Paper today. I think you are just fantastic.
Well, thank you, Patsy. I always love coming on to speak with you.
Okay. Bye-bye now. Bye.
Okay. Take care.
Okay. You too. Okay. Woo! I love this book. I'm holding it up to the camera for those of you. It's bright and colorful. And as I said, the writing inside, it's exactly... If you saw my printing, it looks exactly the same. It's quite amazing. Wonderful books, wonderful illustrations, and this is an example of how she got her daughter involved. There she is writing these books, and her daughter's drawings captured her characters, and it's so nice. And I'm sure that anyone who has teenagers out there, young people who need to have something fun to read, they will enjoy this. And anyone... this is the time, you know, September, school started in end of August, September, and in schools everywhere across the country, you have all these groups of kids, you know, they all get together, and some like each other, some don't like each other, and then they get into all these things. And the Dork Diaries, I think, help put it in perspective, and perhaps it is a way to open a conversation with the young people in your life about looking beyond your own group, finding the best in every group, and trying to get together and trying to do something good for each other and trying to do something to help the world. And Rachel Renee Russell is just, she's such a sweetheart. And I think that what she's accomplished, I mean, when you think about 45 million books in 40 languages, this is such an accomplishment. And she's done it because she was determined. That's for sure. This happens sometimes. You have a need. You have to get out there and you have to do something. You know that you want to make a difference in this world. And that's what happened with Rachel. And she stuck to it. And I can tell you, when you're 400 weeks on the New York Times bestselling list, this is amazing. And she is going to, as I said, her books have been optioned. And I think that we will see in very short time the diaries being turned into a major motion picture or a series. Probably they say they want to do a motion picture, and it's been picked up by Lionsgate, so you can't get much better than that. And they're going to make a motion picture about it. And as she calls them, the adorkable fans of Dork Diaries, they're massive numbers. Millions and millions of kids have read these books now. And they all have seen these images created by Nikki, and they know what the stories are about, and it's going to be a fantastic motion picture. So we're going to take a commercial break, and when I come back, I have an amazing author who is going to take us on an epic journey. Well, many epic journeys, 245 to be exact, and we'll be right back.
This is the Tantalk Radio Network.
Do you dread being called on to speak at meetings or family functions? Have you envied those who can sway an audience with well-chosen words? Do you know that people who speak well earn more money, earn more rewarding careers? Gain the confidence to master any speaking situation. Toastmasters will allow you to find your voice. Go to toastmasters.org to locate the club nearest you.
Are you an author, an artist, an inventor? Then you need to protect your valuable intellectual property. You need Larson & Larson. We have the experience and knowledge to help you with all of your legal needs, from processing trademark, copyright, or patent applications, to negotiating licensing agreements and handling litigation. The attorneys at Larson & Larson in Largo, Florida can help protect you. Call us today for a no-cost consultation at 727-546-0660 or visit our website at larsonpatentlaw.com.
How many of you listening today yearn to write stories, poems, or novels? Each of you has a story to tell, or knows of a story that others would love to read if only you could put the words on a page. The many writers' clubs in the Bay Area understand this urge and would welcome any new writer to learn with them. So go ahead and take the first step to becoming a well-known author. Sponsored by the Pinellas Writers Club.
This is the Tantalk Radio Network.
This is Patsy with a Z, and I am back, and I have my next guest, and this is exciting. I'm always so thrilled to have anyone from Nat Geo, but particularly this author who I just love, and I'm so happy to welcome him back to Joy on Paper, George Stone. Hi, George.
How are you doing? It's good to talk to you again.
Okay, well, you know, I love you. Did I ever tell you that my favorite name is George? I name my pets George. I've always loved the name George. And as a matter of fact, I have a 14-foot giraffe at my front door, and his name is George. And every morning I say, "Good morning, George." So
that's funny. Well, that's good. Then in solidarity with all of the Georges, I applaud your good taste, and we appreciate your support. George is, you know, George actually basically means farmer, the Greek root of it. It comes, and it also, like, the first three letters, Geo, is like National Geographic.
Yeah.
So that's the world, Earth. And then the second half of the word means work, so it's like earth worker or farmer. So I'm not a farmer myself, but I happen to marry someone with the last name Farmer. So maybe these names really mean something.
It was meant to be. Geo. I mean, how isn't that perfect for George Stone to be? You are so amazing. You are so amazing.
Well, thank you. This is really good for my self-esteem. I haven't even had to do anything yet. Thank you.
You know, I always love Nat Geo books. I can spend, and I do spend hours with them. And the new book is called Epic Journeys, 244 Life-Changing Adventures. And, of course, I immediately went through it to see if I had done any of them myself. And I have. I've done some of them. And I was always so excited about that. And so tell us, you know, as always, I want to thank Nat Geo. First of all, they create such wonderful books, and they are priced so reasonably. Everybody, this book is so reasonable, and it's filled with 400 pictures, I think, 400 beautiful photographs. Everything is absolutely delightful in this book, and you really can spend hours going through it.
Well, thank you. Yeah, I mean, we are really proud of this book. I have to say that we have an embarrassment of riches here at National Geographic, especially photographically. National Geographic has been around since 1888 with a mission of conservation, exploration, and documenting the world in words and in photos. So when we were piecing this book together, we just were sitting on a mountain of spectacular images. And every image, every picture tells a story, but these pictures tell like 100 stories because we are able to talk to the photographers and figure out, well, why were you in Mongolia? Why did you take this picture? Who is it with this lovely picture of a boy sitting on in a traditional Mongolian nomad sitting on his family's reindeer? And there are these big furry antlers, and the reindeer almost looks like he's smiling. But we're able to talk to the photographers and really get their firsthand account of where they were and how they took this picture. And something that's interesting about National Geographic photographers that isn't always really sort of heralded is that they're not just experts in photography, but in order to get the images, they have to be experts at mountain climbing or scuba diving, or they really have to know their ecology, or they have to have a sense of history or biology. They're really well schooled, and they also often have to have tons of patience to get these images. I was talking to one photographer named Tim Lehman, who hangs out in Borneo's rainforest taking pictures of birds of paradise, these majestic birds, and he'll have to he'll climb up a tree and build a little tree house hut to house his camera, and he'll sit there for days and days and weeks studying birds and then waiting for just the right moment when the bird will show up. So, I mean, the book kind of represents a lot of that photographic work, and then it also represents our writing and our ideas about where people should travel in the world.
Well, it is beautiful, and they have to be brave. Your photographers and have to be brave because they go to dangerous places in the world to bring us these photos.
Yeah, I think that's sort of part of what makes National Geographic unique. Is we invest a lot in our stories and in the storytellers. So. Some stories, which are not in this book because our book is for travelers and people who are curious about getting out there, but some stories that National Geographic documents, track health crises like Ebola. And so a great photographer named Pete Muller, ventures into dangerous zones and conflict zones some of the time and takes pictures and contributes to stories that tell us something important that's happening in the world. And I think when we know what's happening in the world, we feel more connected. So people could be far away. They could be quite different. But if we travel a little bit and maybe read a little bit and just sort of spend more time thinking about how we're connected in the world, then I think when crises come up, we feel more part of the solution, too. There's something we can do, or there's some way we can support toward a better resolution.
Well, all of the book is fascinating. I particularly enjoyed the top 10 adventures to places before they disappear.
Oh, yeah. So the book has a bunch of top 10 lists, and these are really cool. The top 10 train trips in Europe, top 10 birding experiences, top 10 safari experiences. So the one that you mentioned, Places Before They Disappear, really has a lot to do with our changing planet. And as a result of lots of different things, population increase, the growth of tourism, and also climate change, the planet is in flux. And it's sometimes very important to get to see places before they change too much, which is sad, but the glacier, for instance, the fabled snows of Kilimanjaro. The glacier is the top Africa's highest mountain, which straddles the border of Kenya and Tanzania. You know, those glaciers are melting, and when they go, they'll be gone, and that is largely a result of climate change over a long span of time. But there are a lot of other places that are being actively protected, and UNESCO, the World Heritage Organization, does step in to protect physical places, sort of wild places, and then cultural traditions. So in the place to go before they disappear, one that I like is the Mekong River floating markets, and this is in Southeast Asia. The Mekong River flowing up from the delta in Vietnam, up north toward Cambodia. You know, this is a long tradition of people living by the river, living on homes and stilts, and moving through life, selling their goods by boat, you know, whether it's sometimes even cooking on these little floating boats. So you can experience that within Southeast Asia, but because of the pace of change in the world, most likely that is a tradition and a way of life that will start to fade in the coming decades.
Well, as I said, I went through to see how many I had been to. Not enough. And that's
never
one of the,
enough. That's the problem.
Never enough. But it was fun to find ones that I had been on, like the Muir Trail. And of course, I'm from Michigan, so we had Isle Royale there in Michigan. And what? How many of them have you been on? Have you counted how many you have been on?
No, I have not. But I don't think that I would score very high. I mean, the world is just so full of experience, and you know, travel isn't a competition to get to see more places. It is, though, an opportunity for people to go out and you know, see things that matter to them. And so we want to connect people with their own curiosities and places where they can explore this. So that's why a section about birding makes a lot of sense. If you know, birds are so important, and they're indicator species of the health of habitats around the world, and if you're a little bit interested in birds, then that is an amazing window that you can fly through to just hundreds of different destinations around the world and develop on your curiosity and let your curiosity guide you. So there are so many things in this book that I've never done. You know, no one is expected to do them all, but I think everywhere you go, you know, it can tell you a little bit more about the story of our planet. So that's why we're trying to stretch this book out to include as much as we possibly can.
Well, it's important, and because also one of the things that's happening, there are places that are sometimes are getting over visited. This is a problem that you've mentioned in you have a blog, right?
That's exactly right. Yeah, thanks so much, Becky, for reading that. That was really nice of you. So National Geographic, you know, stands for conserving places in the world. And as important as tourism is, as the world's largest economic driver, actually, over-tourism is a sort of newly coined concept that relates to places being inundated by tourists, you know, places that are extremely crowded. You could imagine the hordes of crowds around the Mona Lisa, for instance. Everyone wants to see the painting in Paris. So one of the challenges for people who are working in travel is to try to encourage people to visit under-touristed places, you know, places which also presents a better experience. So An example of that, that's a far-off example, for instance, might be that for safaris, the Ngorongoro crater in Tanzania, in the Serengeti Plain, near it, is a very popular destination. And in peak season, there are probably too many people there for that ecosystem. However, just south, 1,000 miles in Zambia, is a much less discovered safari area. And Zambia is named partly for the Zambezi River, and the Zambezi River flows to Victoria Falls. And Victoria Falls is popular, but safaris, walking safaris in Zambia, are rare, uncrowded, and quite remarkable because it's one of the few places in Africa where you really can get out of your safari truck and walk around and the animals won't eat you, which is an important part of safari going if you want to come home alive.
Yeah, yeah.
So we also point out, you know, closer to home, there are some 5 to 6 million people went to the Grand Canyon this year. This year is the 100th anniversary of the Grand Canyon as a national park. So then we also want to say, well, what other national parks can people go to that are less visited and where people can have a less crowded experience? So the questions about managing tourism are really pressing and are important, but at the same time, the world is ours, everyone. So getting out there to see what's beautiful and to see what really is a part of our story on this planet is, I think, a gift and an opportunity for everyone.
Well, there is a beautiful picture on page 80 of two giraffes. I'm sort of a giraffe person for some reason.
Of course, your friend George.
You know, and I see them there, and they are in Botswana, and I think, that's a trip I would like to take. As a matter of fact, I went to Disneyland, you know, Disney World here, where they have the safari park and the hotel that you can rent so that the giraffes actually come right up to your balcony and eat, you know, and there's right there within. I enjoyed that so much because I'm sort of,
yeah,
you know,
it's amazing. Having a wildlife encounter really is a rare and unforgettable experience. I was kayaking on Vancouver Island, or off of Vancouver Island, about a month ago, near Tofino, which is this beautiful small town, and kayaking around these old growth redwood forests. And we saw a bear, you know, hanging out, coming down to the shore. We saw otters and sea lions. And of course, fish and eagles, and it was just, you know, majestic. The world is their world, really, and to see animals in a natural habitat and to recognize that you're a visitor and they're not, is sort of like puts things in the right perspective.
Well, and it does. I think also it helps from that point of view. If people get connected to animals and they start thinking about the importance of saving the animals, you know, they do a trip and they see animals, they and it's funny, I was in New York recently and those people living in New York, not only they don't even know about cars, I mean they don't drive a car, let alone know you know, go out and see a wild animal. It's even for them to go to the zoo is a big thing. But for somebody like me from Michigan, where we were surrounded by wildlife, and even now my brother lives up there, and the deer come to his backyard. So we care about animals, you know, they really mean something to us. So if people take these trips and they have these encounters, I think it really does help for later on to get them to support conservation.
I think so. I mean, and that's also a great thing to share with kids and grandkids is, you know, it can be very hard with, you know, the hectic schedules of everyone today and kids. especially, to make some time just to go out into the wilderness. You know, it doesn't have to be super far away. It could just be a regional park. But, you know, kids sometimes are might be like, oh, this is extra super boring. And you have to say, no, this is not. This is important because you're spending a little bit of time. But also, you know, ecosystems change around the world. If you can get some sort of sense of where you live, and I grew up in Toledo, Ohio, I'm familiar with that region. If you can get a sense of where you live and where your origins are, then every other place you visit is a great point of comparison. And you say, oh, that's interesting. Wow, I don't know that. You know, we don't have bedrock like this. You know, our trees only grow so long because of our sandy soil. And, you know, we have different kinds of trees. And our squirrels in Toledo, Ohio are giant, fat, red squirrels that are like, look like they're 20 pounds and they're bigger than my terrier. But here in Washington, D.C., they're like lithe little gray squirrels that are prancing about. And it's, you know, tiny differences, but I think they matter.
And now, speaking about kayaking, one of the photographs in the book is people kayaking in Venice.
Yeah, and that story, that is a great little story, because that was written by one of our favorite contributors. And that is, that story was really kind of all about perspective in a way. You know, it's, you don't have to go do everything everyone says you're supposed to do. And you don't have to do it the way, you know, the way anyone else has done it. So getting that, you know, a sort of a water-up perspective of from the canals in Venice, where you're putting a bit more of your own effort into exploring, I think focuses you as well, and you see things differently. It's not a passive tour where you're on a boat and you're being sort of, you know, cruised around, but you're investing more. So it was just a cool story. Of course, you're still in Venice and you've seen this history. You're also more connected with the rising waters of Venice, so that's an interesting perspective, too.
Well, and the photographs are beautiful. And probably it's cheaper to rent a kayak than to take a gondola, where they charge you $400 a ticket now, if you haven't been to Venice lately.
Yeah, well, yeah. I mean, that's, I think, the, you know, saving money is no small thing. And it's just because you've set aside money to travel doesn't mean you have to blow it all on the iconic experiences.
Exactly.
That's just not the point.
Exactly.
And so I think it's really important when, like, one of my friends here at work took her two kids to Paris. And guess what? They just didn't need to see the Mona Lisa. And in fact, they really didn't need to see any of the kind of like formal museums. They were there for a little bit. So we looked at a map, and I happen to know of some cool little, a great ice cream shop on Ile Saint-Louis.
Oh, I know that ice cream shop.
Notre Dame. Yeah, Bertillon.
Oh, yeah.
And, you know, and then I know another place, which I'm sure you know, in the Marais, the Macron place, the delicious, now I can't remember it, but it's La Rey, Macrons. And then there's another place that has chocolate. And I said, well, look, you know, why would kids want to go some of the time to look at whatever's hanging on the wall in a museum? Wouldn't it be cool if you just rented bikes, biked around, eat these delicious things, and get into a neighborhood, get lost a little bit, eat a baguette, who knows? But just really enjoy being there instead of doing the thing that everyone says you're supposed to do.
Exactly. You have a feel for it, and that, I think, makes you want to go back again. We did that with our boys, and I think they enjoyed so much just walking around, eating crepes, you know, made right there on the street corner. And, of course, as you said, just just getting a feel for the city was more important than, I don't know why anyone would stand in front of the Mona Lisa to take a selfie. It boggles my mind. It just, I don't know.
Yeah.
It's too much.
Yeah,
for me.
It just seems, I mean, but, you know, it's part of our world. As long as you are taking a selfie and not accidentally backing off a cliff, you're at least not doing it, having a complete disaster.
Yeah.
But I think creating like memorable, travel's not a competition. So doing it the way you want to do it, the way you need to do it, is really the right way to do it.
And so often it really does come down to just taking it easy and just getting out there and strolling around and seeing, as you said, some of the greatest adventures I ever had in Europe were the ones where I got lost. I mean, completely lost. Lost for 7 hours circling all the streets of Rome looking for my hotel. 7 hours.
Yeah.
7 hours. But it was all right because we had a white Cadillac. And so we went through Rome for 7 hours trying to find our hotel. But it was it was lots of fun. When we drove down streets where people had to jump into doorways because there was no room left on the street for them. This was part of the fun. So, yeah, I just turned to sauna in Finland. You know, I'm a Youper.
I'm from
the Upper Peninsula of Michigan. And, of course, everybody has saunas up there. But this sauna, oh, wow, this sauna is so gorgeous. It's cut right there in the ice. I love this.
Yeah. Yeah. That's also a cool idea is, to go to the origin of anything, the place where something really kind of established itself, whether it's a food tradition or a sauna, that is exactly the idea of connecting a dot in the world. You're like, why is sauna really cool? Like, where did that come from? And you can go see how it's done traditionally. And some of the time, the way it's done traditionally can be surprising. It can be, it can be rustic, or it could involve multiple steps. You know, it's not just going to the gym and sitting there for like 20 minutes, but it's, an actual activity that's social. You might do it with your family. And so, and it's also responsive to the climate,
So
it's interesting stuff.
I'm stuck here looking at the sauna again because we still on our farm up in Michigan, we still have the traditional sauna and we actually do go to the sauna and jump into the snow.
Oh, wow. Okay, so, then you're doing it right.
That's
crazy.
We do it the right way. And my brother called 2 weeks ago, and he was so happy because it was snow. There's snow in Michigan already in the middle of October, and so he's just waiting. He's going to get in that sauna and jump out in the snow. He's going to love
That's
this
great.
Photograph. And everybody, really, this book is so wonderful. And, of course, George Stone, what's your official title? You're, like, so important.
I'm the editor-in-chief of National Geographic Travel.
Wow.
So I'm in charge of our travel content online and in print and in books and everything.
Okay, well, people, get this book, Epic Journeys, 245 Life-Changing Adventures. And it just even will just change your life as you're reading them because your mind will expand. You'll learn things that you didn't know, and you'll just have hours of fun. And holidays are coming up. And I'm telling you, if you're going to go to somebody's house for Thanksgiving dinner, the best thing you can do is to bring and make it a family tradition, the tradition of your life. Take a Nat Geo book with you to Thanksgiving dinner, because after people are stuffed with the turkey, they need a couple hours to sit around. And the best thing is to look at the wonderful photographs in a Nat Geo book. How about that?
Well, thanks. I couldn't agree more.
No,
so
really,
thank you,
really, maybe that you should use that as an advertising gimmick. You know, show people coming, do an ad, really, and promote bringing, that's what I'm bringing to every everything I'm invited to at Thanksgiving. I bring a Nat Geo book. I say, we have time. Sit down. Relax. We have, between the time we eat the turkey and have the pumpkin pie, we have time to travel the world, thanks to George Stone and all of his wonderful people at Nat Geo. We get to see the world and to experience something wonderful. And George, I want to thank you so much. You're welcome here anytime, and I am just so thrilled. And I want to mention your blog, which is Muckrack, and you have very fascinating stories there, and I hope that people will go to that.
Well, good. Yeah, we're publishing every day at natgeotravel.com, and also we have a weekly newsletter, a Nat Geo Travel newsletter. So we are all around, and we love writing about travel and seeing people go places.
Okay, well, I'm promoting the tradition. Don't go to Thanksgiving dinner without a Nat Geo book in your hand, okay?
Good. I love it.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you, George. Bye-bye now. Bye. Ooh, that's nice. This book is $40. You cannot believe it. It weighs a ton. I'm schlepping this book. It's so heavy. It's so big. Well, I don't have to tell you, Nat Geo does the best photographs in the world. And for $40, I mean, it's cheaper than flowers. If you're going to somebody's house, you know, flowers don't, and or a bottle of wine, they probably already have wine. They already have a lot of flowers. I mean, after all, they're having a party. So they've got the wine. They got the... Bring a Nat Geo book. It will be appreciated, because then it'll stay. People will keep these forever. These are not the kind of books that turn up in a garage sale. And for $40, and you can sign your name, and, you know, 40 years from now, 50 years from now, people will say, oh, I remember when he came, and he came here, and he brought this wonderful book, and now he's an old man. And whatever. So buy a Nat Geo book, and you will be always a welcome guest at any party that you attend if you bring your host and hostess a Nat Geo book. Okay, well, I've had a wonderful day because I got to talk to Rachel Renee Russell. And as I said, she is one of my very favorite authors. Think of it, people, 45 million. Do you understand? 45 million books. I mean, it blows your mind when you think about it. And she never, I'm sure when she started, she never believed. I mean, she was happy with a million. And now she's 45 million and counting, because when you're 400 weeks on the New York Times bestselling list, the numbers keep multiplying and they go up exponentially or something like that, because they're pretty fantastic. So remember, one of the joys of life is to see your words on paper, or to hear them spoken in an audible book, or if you're really, really lucky, to hear those magic words, lights, camera, action, and your book will be turned into a streaming video, a major motion picture, or a series on the Hallmark Channel. You never know, and you won't know unless you start writing. And that's what you have to do. November is coming up, and that's National Novel Writing Month, and we're going to be talking about that next week. Meanwhile, say something nice to somebody, and I will say something nice to Big Ed in the control room. Thank you, Ed. Thank you for everything. And he's saluting me, and I'm saluting him. Bye-bye now. Bye, everybody.